All right, folks, welcome back to the Game Trail Podcast. My voice sounds even extra funky today. I'm feeling a little under the weather. I got another head cold. I'm a little bit embarrassed because our guest, last time I talked to him at the Hunt Expo, I was sick, which I can't figure it out. I spent all weekend in a gym at my youngest kid's basketball games. I don't know if I picked it up there or not, but pardon my voice today. But yeah, I'm going to introduce my guest here in a second. Before I get started, I'm going to hit you guys with a promo code. You can use the promo code GAMETRAIL. That's GAMETRAIL. And you want to sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account with that promo code. You're going to get $50 back into the Go Hunt gear shop. You can use that towards the purchase of any gear that you want in the shop, including, you know, you can use that towards the new purchase of a Kafaru backpack, which is going to link into our guest here today. we'll dive into. Also, I wanted to shout out Matthews Archery. Those guys have been a sponsor of my podcast. I put new strings on my bow over the weekend. I got my brother has not bow hunted for probably 15 years. And, last bull he killed was a 379 inch bull, only bull he's ever killed with a bow. And he quit after that. And he's decided he wants to get back into bow hunting. And so he'll be showing up today just as soon as I get off the podcast. I'm going to set him up with my lift from last year. So get a new bow hunter back in the game. He's super excited. And yeah, just shout out to Matthews for making a great product. So with that, I'm going to introduce my guest. My guest today is Kenneth Thrall. Do you go by Ken or Kenneth?
Either or. I have so many different. You know, either Ken, Kenny, Kenneth, but yeah, whatever flows with you best.
Your mom call you Kenneth when she gets mad at you?
Yeah. The Kenneth Richard.
Richard, there you go. Yeah. The full name. Thanks for jumping on with me today. Give me an idea, first and foremost, like where you're at, what you do. You work for Kafaru, but I don't know that I actually know your official job title.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So working for Kafaru, I've been here for the last 3 years. And I kind of don't really have a specific job title, kind of just like a Swiss Army knife. Do a lot of different things, wear different hats, just whatever kind of needs to be done. Right now in this time of year, like we're having a lot of the shows and stuff. So kind of mainly doing that, the shows and all the other stuff. But yeah, just kind of the Swiss Army knife of Kafaru.
A middle infielder. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Utility player.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So you've been there for 3 years, you said?
Yes. Yep.
Gotcha. Did you move with them from Colorado to Wyoming, or were you living in Wyoming?
So I was living in Western Oregon. Okay. And then I saw that Kafaru was moving up to Wyoming. I lived in Wyoming out of high school for a couple years and then had to move back to Oregon, but I wanted to come back to Wyoming no matter what. And just saw the opportunity of them moving to Riverton and, you know, they're going to need to hire people. So just hit them up saying, hey, like I'm going to move to Riverton, see if I can get a job. And however, you know, it all worked out and stuff like that. So just got my foot in the door.
How, you said you lived in Wyoming after you got out of high school? Mm-hmm. Did you go to college in Wyoming?
No. So I, just out of high school, building houses and stuff. My brother was moving to the Star Valley. So he moved over there and I was like, whatever, I'm just, you know, kind of free and open. So I moved there with him and then I was just there working different jobs and, I loved it. Like obviously, you know, Western Oregon to Western Wyoming, completely different, but sure. I loved the big mountains and mule deer and elk and everything. So, but they ended up moving to North Idaho and the Star Valley right now, if anybody doesn't know, it's like mini Jackson.
Yeah.
The prices there a bit much and for a 19-year-old kind of hard to live there. So, I had to move back to Oregon. And then my whole thing when I moved back was I was going to save up money and then moved to Wyoming and kind of the opportunity came with Kafaru. And I was like, this is kind of a good opportunity. And also I'd saved up enough money to buy a house. So.
Oh, nice.
House here. Yeah. Yeah. So homeowner.
Free, free and clear. Or are you paying a mortgage still?
Paying a mortgage still. Yeah.
There you go. I was going to say, Kenneth, you figured it out, man. You're going to have to give me some financial lessons if you own a home outright.
Yeah. Yeah. But I still got it for a crazy deal. Like it's only like $110,000, which, you know, for a house locked like a 3.5 interest rate and everything like right before the boom. So yeah, definitely good deal and all that stuff and love the house. It's pretty tiny, but for me, it's just perfect.
Yeah. How do you like living in Wyoming?
Oh, I love it, but I'm not going to tell anyone to move here, but
you're not? I've been telling everybody to move to Wyoming.
the winters are rough, guys. Definitely a little too much, but yeah. I love it, especially if you're, you know, into the outdoors, if you're an outdoor kind of person. I think when people move here and they're not into the outdoors or something like that, it's going to be hard to live in here. But for me, it's perfect. Like, you have, you know, the hunting opportunities, obviously, you know, I get to hunt, you know, units that it's going to take people 8 years to draw from a non-resident, and I can hunt it every year as a general. So as the hunting opportunities are insane, like elk here are, I mean, I've hunted all over the West and elk here is insane. Like, there's so many, and you know, I don't have to go scout for elk. You know, they're going to be out there and everything. And the deer hunting opportunities, obviously it's the mecca of, you know, a lot of the big hunting mountain mule deer and stuff. And
sure.
I spent a lot of time on that, and definitely I've gotten hooked on a mule deer, but it's for hunting opportunities and outdoor activities, like the state that's the least populated state in the whole, you know, US. So you can go out hiking. You're not going to be crowded with people or anything like that, but I love it. It's definitely, I have zero plans of leaving. I know that.
Yeah. What's your application look like as far as like applying in the West? Do you apply other places, or where you have such good opportunities, and I talk to people all the time, whether they live in like Montana or Idaho or Wyoming, you know, generally they don't apply as much as somebody like that lives in Southern Utah, like myself, where my home state opportunities are just kind of slim to none. what's your application look like each fall? Do you venture out into other states? You just pretty much keep it high and tight and just hunt right there in Wyoming.
Yeah. So like I will apply other places and build points everywhere. The thing is like, I don't look for hunts, like say a rut hunt in another state for elk or any sort of high country hunts for deer in September. I have it here, you know, and some of the best in the whole West. So I don't look for those type of hunts, but what I look for is those later season hunts like Montana. Obviously those late tags, those general tags, they run forever. I've hunted Montana the last 2 years, Idaho, and you know, any sort of deer tag there. I kind of like getting those later deer tags. I drew an Arizona tag 2 years ago. So I'm always looking, and whatever I can kind of piece in. September is Wyoming for me. Like, that's true. October and November, I'm kind of looking everywhere else. And like, you know, within Wyoming, the seasons here, they're kind of September, October. There's nothing really happening in November. Yep. So I look for, you know, Montana, November, Idaho, November, even Nebraska, it's so close. That's something that's nice here is I'm central to everything around me.
Yeah.
Like I can get to Idaho in 4 hours. I can get to Montana in 4 hours, Nebraska four, Colorado in four. Ironically enough, I haven't hunted Colorado at all.
Yeah.
But in Wyoming, it's just I don't look for anything in the month of September. Just going to be focusing here. But in that November, I'll start, you know, looking around, and I build points all over.
Yeah.
But yeah, just kind of, I love hunting, and anytime I can, especially from August, you know, August to December, I'm going to be trying to find tags everywhere.
So you like your applications in other states, if you apply in Arizona or, you know, a Utah or Nevada or wherever it might be, do you kind of take more of a swing for the fences approach? Because you're like, if I'm going to leave Wyoming, I want to leave for something that's really super quality, right?
Yep. Gotcha. Yeah, no, I swing for the fences and just keep building points, yeah. You know, especially in like Arizona. But like, yeah, I'm not going to leave the state in September unless it's something that's just insane, you know,
right.
Like, yeah, because the deer here and the elk here on general tags are very solid. Even in my home state, like for deer and elk, I'll swing for the absolute fences because a general deer tag here, I almost don't want to draw some of those other high premium tags because like, I want to hunt late season, you know, for big bucks, or go hunt them in the high country in early season, you know, for a general.
For sure.
But for elk, I'll swing for the fences here just because the general tag, it is so good.
A guaranteed opportunity to chase elk. Yeah. What is your favorite species to hunt? You brought up mule deer a little bit earlier, but like, I know you love to hunt elk. I know you like to hunt bears.
So
I don't know if you've killed the antelope. You killed the antelope?
Yeah. So. No. In Oregon, you couldn't really hunt antelope at all.
Yeah.
It's a joke. At least try to draw a tag there for an antelope. So once I moved here, I've shot several antelope now. But and if you look at the draw system, if you're a resident, you can get a tag every year. Just whatever, you know, whatever hunt you want. I don't really care. A goat looks cool to me no matter what, a 55 inch goat or anything like that. So,
sure.
The last 2 years I've shot two nice bucks with a bow. So they're fun. They are fun. I'd say antelope is probably my least favorite.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good in August, August 15th, it opens here. So it's a good, prime, you know, to prime yourself up for stalking deer and everything. So I will be out doing that every year, but, I'd say right now in the last 2.5 years, 2 to 3 years, it's been mule deer has been my favorite. I spent my whole life, you know, from 12 years old till, you know, 24, I was just obsessed with elk, like so obsessed. That's all I would focus on growing up in Oregon too. I mean, we had blacktails and stuff and blacktails were fun. But I just loved hunting Roosevelts. And if I went to other states and hunted Rockies, but the last few years, especially hunting in Wyoming and the opportunities that you have and the scouting and everything going into it, it's definitely mule deer's at my highest right now.
Gotcha.
And then, and you're not gonna like this, but I'd say black bears are probably my second.
No, that's all right. No, yeah. I don't discriminate. Mostly I just like to give Brady shit. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't really care. I just like to get under Brady's skin a little bit from time to time. So I get it. What is it about mule deer and bears then? Because he kind of feels the same way, and I know how he feels, but I'm curious to see if it's the same types of things that intrigue you.
I think it's just the aspect, especially with mule deer, is I'm scouting, and when you're scouting in the high country, you're seeing a lot of bucks a day. Like even, you know, one hillside, if you find them, like 30 bucks. But then out of those 30 bucks, you're like, I wouldn't shoot, you know, any of them. It just, you're trying to find that one or a couple bucks in this basin that are mature and everything of that age class, also with inches and everything. I love finding old bucks. Kind of that chess match. And that was 3 years ago. Second time moving back to Wyoming, hunted this buck. I found him August 20th, and just big, heavy deer and old, I could tell. And I hunted that deer till September 16th when I killed him. And the chess match and just the whole thing of him and how different he moved from the other deer. Mm-hmm. Like I would see the 2.5, 3.5 year olds every day. I would only see him once every 10 days, you know, and it's only a 600 yard stretch of what I can see.
Right.
And so I think that aspect of just like really trying to figure them out, and you can still do that with elk and like, you know, and everything. I've got so hooked into those big, you know, old KG mule deer. And then with bears, I'm not sure. Maybe it's the time of year because if it's a fall bear, I'm not going to care about it at all. I would be hunting elk and deer, you know, and everything. But in spring, it's like you're getting out of that cabin fever, kind of you just ready to go hiking and stuff. And you're hunting, and I hunt them spot and stock. I don't really ever have hunted them on a bait.
Yep.
But it's just you're mounting hunting. So it's like I feel like it's more of a style of like a mule deer hunt than it is anything else, because you're trying to find something. You know, you're not going to see a ton of them, but you're just trying to pinpoint one and
the one
to them. Mm-hmm. Yep. Pinpoint one. And you're still mountain hunting. Like if anything, the spring is a really good time to test gear as well, because the unpredictable weather, like you get swings and stuff like that. But, I don't know. Bears are just cool. I mean, you find them and they're in some steep stuff, like, on cliffs and everything like that. But, I think it's just, I like those hunts. And then, but last year I hunted, I hunt elk every year, especially I'll always hunt elk, especially with a bow.
Yep.
But last year, like, cause I got back from the moose hunt and everything, and then went right into elk, and it was like the best 3 days of elk hunting I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, I was like, I do love this, you know, like, when there's bulls cranking everywhere, I'm like,
it's just a different type of fun. Right. I would say that, you know, archery elk hunting is more of a type one fun, right? Like you have days that are legit really, really fun where you're having close interactions with bulls and they're screaming and the rut's rolling. It's more interactive, more dynamic. I would say it's like more fun, but, to your point, to kill a big mature mule deer, I would say it's more type two fun, where 99% of the time it really sucks. Like there's not a lot going on. You're just sitting, glassing, grinding out the day. A lot of the times you're super bored, but I think that goes along with that. The sense of satisfaction that you feel from killing a really big mature mule deer is unmatched, because you really did. You felt like you did something. Like it was hard. It's hard.
Yeah. And you know? Like even last year, the buck I killed and like I was hunting these specific deer, I scouted those bucks throughout the summer. And meanwhile, a 7 hour round trip for me to go scout these bucks, but I scouted them 7 weekends before season, and just trying to figure out. And that's where I think like the success with the deer hunt is kind of delayed and like very calculated.
Yeah.
With elk, it's like split decision. Like you got to decide and like get everything going very quickly. Cause I figured out, you know, try to figure out those bucks as much as I can and then kill them opening day in the exact plan that I wanted. I feel like that's kind of like the satisfaction rate of that.
Yeah. I've always said, and I don't know who said, somebody probably said it before I said it, but I always said, you know, with mule deer, all the hunting, it gets done in the summer. From like July, like middle of July to August, like that's when all your hunting gets done, and then opening day is for killing.
Yes.
You know, if you've done it right. And there's it's just super satisfying when it works out that way. It's
and that's my favorite thing when people say, because like this year I shot my buck 10 minutes into opening light, like shot him, and you get to be like, oh man, you're already done, like, you know, you're gonna be sad about it. I'm like, no, like I've been for 2 months I've been hunting pretty much, you know what I mean? Like I've been waiting for that moment and I want to kill him right 10 minutes into opening day, or, you know, everything opening day. Cause that is the whole hunt, like scouting and everything like that. It's just finally when you have a bow in your hand, that's when you're supposed to, you know, you're going to execute. But
what have you learned about hunting mature mule deer?
The most, like in terms of just like what I've learned within deer and everything.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm just curious. It's a broad question, but I'm curious to see where you take it. But yeah, what have you learned? What a big mule deer? What is it about big mule deer, older mature mule deer, that you think might be different than what you might have thought, or what some people might think?
I think it's like every animal is just like humans and stuff like that. Nothing's the same, you know. And that's something I noticed the last 3 years in hunting, like in shooting older bucks. They're just so the unpredictable part of it, because like I said, like I'll see the younger bucks and everything every single day, morning and evening, but the older bucks just kind of, and typically what I've seen is those deer, will be by themselves or just with a couple bucks. This year I did was the first time I had like a real big deer, and he would be with like seven other bucks, and that's the unpredictable part. Right. And I'm not sure his age and stuff like that, but, I think it's just with every deer, it's going to be different in different scenarios. Like,
yeah,
in the terrain dependent, like the deer I was hunting 3 years ago, he was in very heavy timber, kind of avalanche shoot kind of stuff, and they're big, big meadow bottoms, but he would never come down on the bottom. He'd stay, you know, right in that line with the trees, and he would never come out in the open fully. Like he'd just be in those avalanche shoots or stuff like that. And between the deer I shot the year after that, he was in like this steep, avalanche, or not avalanche shoot, but just like cliffs, but huge open country. But he was on the backside of stuff to where I never saw him once. I scouted that thing 4 weekends in a row, never saw him. And then when I went stalked another deer, I came back and was checking those cliffs, and he was bedded on the backside in this micro little spot. I think it's hard to scout country and be able to see every single deer that's in that country.
Yeah.
And within mature bucks, especially, because they seem to not want to be as social and also out as much. Like, obviously, they learn and everything like that between hunting, but probably predators.
Yeah.
This is something I just noticed within hunting mature deer. Nothing's going to be the same, but there's still going to be tendencies of what is the same. And the last 3 years I've killed, like, very, like, old deer. They've always been in spots that are very micro topography. Like, not big open basins where you can see them. They're in these little pockets that have feed, they have water, and they have bedding, and that's all they need. So that's been the biggest thing I've seen over the last few years.
Does that kind of change the areas that you've scouted? You kind of, you go out now, are those kind of some of the first spots that you look at, whether you're looking like on, you know, your maps or whatever, and then you get actually out on the landscape, are those kind of the first boxes that you check, is like checking these little micro habitats?
Yep. And the cool thing is like some of them I find are not that far from like either a trailhead or a big basin, to where I'm going to go glass this. Like last year I was glassing this big basin and I'm like, this looks great. Right. And I'm seeing bucks everywhere, but then I glass behind me like 3,000 yards in just this little pocket, and boom, I see a big deer. And I'm like, okay. And then I ended up having to move the next weekend to get closer. But, I look at like, you know, those main spots, and like the deer I killed 3 years ago, he was not far from a main trail, like where people hike all the time. Yeah. And he was nine and a half years old, and he lived in this little pocket. No one ever hunted him. Even when I was hunting him, I didn't see a single person. He's a 191-inch deer that was just living on this hillside, you know, in a micro spot. And so I am now, like, I've, you know, I'll mark everywhere and keep pins and stuff like that and look at the topography, elevation, everything like that, and look at new areas now. And I have so many different pins on all my mapping systems, just like of where I want to check out. Because the thing is, I still need to get the age back on this last year's deer, but the 9.5, 3 years ago, the next year after that, that buck was 8.5. And so this one, I'm thinking he's up there with the same as them. But that kind of, it just shows me that there's deer out there that are living long. And like, even that buck I killed 3 years ago, he could have lived and died without anyone ever seeing him.
For sure.
You know? And it's just like that keeps me pretty hungry. Like,
yeah.
Very hungry. Really.
Yeah. 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 When you see something like that and then you have some success and you get the data back on it and you're like, oh man, they're out there. Like they do exist, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I was curious as to, and, you know, feel free to tell me to pound sand if you don't want to answer it, but it's a common question that I get is how is the deer herds there in Wyoming doing? And I had a guy ask me yesterday, he's got 14 points for antelope and he was asking about antelope. You know, my advice to him was like, I probably wouldn't get hung up on, you know, population being down for antelope, because I think there's still enough antelope regardless of the unit that you'll be able to find a nice buck and kill a nice representative species. But yeah, my advice to him was to burn those. But I was curious as to, you know, how are herds doing? I mean, that 2022-3 winter, bad news. I mean, we looked at the draws, people definitely piled off, you know, they didn't want to apply and draw permits. How is it numbers wise? What do you think?
I think, especially after this year, I've kind of seen some reports and everything like that, that we're definitely on the up. Like the winter range was very strong. Mm-hmm. A lot of 2.5, 3.5 year old bucks, that looked healthy and everything. I'll say like in the 2024, summer and going into that season, everyone was telling me like, I am not finding bucks and all this stuff. And I was still struggling to find deer. But I think with that, because it was such a heavy winter and such a delayed melt, all those bucks didn't get up. I didn't find the bucks that I wanted until August 27th. Like,
interesting.
They did not make it. Like the weekend prior was up in the high country. Didn't see a single buck in the spot. Not a single one. Like maybe a little forked horn in the bottom. And then a week later, there was 30 bucks on this high basin.
Huh.
And that was something I was thinking about. It was really, really interesting. And, like, and it kind of hit me like, people aren't finding deer or whatever, you know, and they're not seeing them. But I think it was just such a delayed, you know, green up. They were just taking their time. Like they're in the timber, everything in the low country coming up. I mean, even the desert that year was extremely green. And then this last year, July, you know, 4th of July and July, like 16th or 13th and stuff, I was finding deer in the high country ready to go, primed up. I don't think, like, I think there is an impact in certain herds, you know, in certain basins, like especially maybe region G got hit harder than region H or vice versa. Mm-hmm. But like this year or in 2024, or so it was 2023 was the year prior to the bad winter, but 2024 last year, I found a lot of deer. Like there was every age class, you know, old bucks, middle bucks, you know, 4.5, 3.5, and then 2.5 year olds. It was every age class was in this spot. And I think in a, you know, 1,000 yard stretch, I think I've found over 40 deer, like 40 bucks in this stretch.
It's good.
It was good to see. And that's something like going into, you know, the year prior after the hard winter, I was really nervous going through and I was not finding big deer to save my life. And that was another thing too, is talking to a lot of people, it seemed to be they did not get that growth because of how hard the winter was.
Right.
Like the deer I shot, you know, he was 8.5 and he's a big wide buck, big deep back forks, really short on his fronts. Like really, he's, you know, 160 deer when he should have been 180. Like he's just really like compact, you know, wide and deep, but then just crabbed up. And so I was talking to a lot of people and a lot of people saw that. Like within every, you know, killing older bucks and they're just really, you know, not get, reaching their potential. Between last year, it seemed to be like everything was reaching its potential.
Yeah.
Very healthy deer, a lot of them and everything like that. And then I saw like an Eastman's report and like other things with like talking with them, and they went into the winter range and checked it out, and they said it was good. Like they saw a lot of three and a half year old four points and everything like that. Cause that was another thing in the whole state. You saw the buzz of like, everyone's like, I'm not hunting deer.
Yeah.
Not doing anything like that. And
yep.
people turning back their tags or, you know, eating their tags and everything. Mm-hmm. But my whole premise is, if I can find an old deer, I'm going to be hunting an old buck. And like, and really, if I can find an old mature deer and kill it, that's going to be doing way better than, you know, just going out there shooting the first buck I see.
Sure.
It's just different preferences and stuff like that. But if I have a tag and they give me a general tag, I'm going to be,
Yeah. And I mean, in reality, as an 8.5, 9.5 year old buck, I mean, he may not make it that next year. Do you know what I mean? Depending on what Mother Nature gives him. So
yeah. May not make it, or may not even be, you know, producing at all. You know,
for sure. Yeah. No, that's cool. I wanted to ask you, I was trying to think how to word this. Do you prefer, is there certain types of areas as far as topography, vegetation that you like to hunt, or are you really just looking for an animal, or does that make sense? Like, are there areas that you like to hunt that are like better suited to your style of hunting? Or because I like low country. The reason that I had to start thinking about it is like, if I can find a big buck in low country, I would rather hunt it than any deer at the top of the mountain ever. Like I would rather hunt low because I feel like I'm a better hunter low. And I feel like there's fewer people early season. And, you know, you get areas like Southern Utah, Wyoming, you could probably find deer from all types of vegetation and elevation, you know, bands, like all the way from the low stuff, all the way to the high stuff. Is there stuff that you like to hunt and a reason why?
I like the high country. I think it's mainly because I do like that, like backpacking, mountain hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But with that being said, like I will hunt a buck wherever it's at. Like I do want to find a spot that is stalkable with a bow, you know? And that's the thing with 3 years ago and finding that deer, it was a very hard spot to stalk because there's so much timber. I did get a stalk on him on September 2nd and missed him with my bow and then killed with a rifle later. But I'm going to scout that high country and wherever I think, you know, if there's good green grass and good feed, like even last year, these bucks I found, was not good. Like in theory, not good for archery because they would never bed in the open. If they did, like it would be in the wide open, but also, they'd move pretty quick to the timber. They'd always bed in the strips of timber where I know if I'm going to stalk them, I'm going to stalk blind, which I hate doing that with deer because they're going to be way more keen than me. So I actually had to ambush them because they come over the saddle. At least a couple of the mature bucks would come over the saddle. So I got on the backside in the dark, and then when they – for right at first light, I peeked over the top, and they were 37 yards below me coming up. So I'm going to try to figure out a way to hunt them no matter what. Like even saying if I can't get embedded or stuff like that. With that being said, like last year I was hunting an antelope and I already found all the bucks I did hunting antelope and get up to the spot and I'm glassing and found the biggest 3-point mule deer I've ever seen in my life. Like absolute toad. And I'm like, wow. And he was in a perfect spot to stalk him.
That sounds like fun to me.
Yeah. Like,
and spot and stalk a giant 3-point in antelope country in August sounds sick.
Yeah. Like it is in my mind right now. Cause I'm going to go back in there in the summer and see, if he's still in there and if I can pinpoint what he's kind of doing a little more. Cause I didn't see him the next day and stuff like that. I also didn't look for him too hard. Cause I was hunting antelope, but, he still has been on my mind a bit this last whole year. I'm like, I need to go back in there. Cause it's a spot that nobody goes, like nobody goes. It's, you have to hike in to get there. And also it's the desert and it's going to be September. No one's going to be hunting it deer during that time. And so if I can find a big buck and no matter where I'm at, I'm going to hunt it. And if I go back in there and say that buck, you know, if he's bigger, if he's still alive and everything, I'm going to try to hunt him, but I favor the high country just because the openness of it and being able to find those big bucks. I mean, they get all the nutrients they can up in that high country. And some of those bucks I've seen, at least around, you know, here, they'd be a 5.5, 6.5 year old desert buck that's just not anything, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't hit potential.
Yeah, it doesn't hit potential.
Yeah. Is this a front fork three or back fork three?
He's full on just like that, full on main beam, like cool gotcha. 3-point.
Oh, yeah. Right on. Yeah. Well, man, I hope you turn him up. I'm pulling for him. That's the one I'm pulling for.
That's the one. Yeah. And to be a fully different Griffin grin in the desert compared to the last ones.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you all day. So I want to actually dive into some backpacks and just ask you, I mean, that was the reason I asked you on initially, but I knew we'd end up talking some hunting. give us the rundown on, I guess Kefaru, you've been with Kefaru 3 years. Mm-hmm. What's your guys' facility like up there?
Yeah. So it's, it used to be a big, big R. So like it's a whatever farming thing. So our owner, Chad, he bought the building and everything, and we kind of had to remodel it. And that kind of comes into when I first got hired with Kefaru. They hadn't moved yet. So it was a whole thing of like, I'm living in Riverton. They're still in Denver, and they're like, we're not going to be up there for a couple months. And it came to like, do you want to work on the building? Because the last work I did was contracting and stuff.
Yep.
And so I actually, like the office I'm sitting in, I actually put the studs in. All these and like so we remodeled a bunch of the inside, built offices, built, you know, firewalls and stuff like that. But so it's a big main facility, big building in the front, and then it kind of shoots back, and that's where a lot of our cut and sew is. Eric Bender, that's where his office is and where he's nerding out, you know, new designs and stuff. And then we have another building in the back that has a lot of our fabric and all stuff like that, and some sewers back there that will sew up stuff, but it's two separate kind of buildings, I guess.
So are you guys cutting and sewing everything right there in?
Yeah. So,
everything built right there at Kefaru in Riverton, Wyoming.
Pretty much. So the cut is here. And we have some sewers here that sew a lot of the smaller stuff, originally, cause we're from Denver and like the Wheat Ridge area. Mm-hmm. A lot of our heavy hitters that have sewn our bags for, you know, 20 years, they're still down there. So we have runs every Thursday. We cut here, get everything batched, and then run it down there, drop it off with at a main facility or like a main place, and then they'll come in, home sewers, and then they'll sew up bags and everything like that.
Okay.
So we still have everything sewn, you know, in Riverton and in Denver. But yeah, our cut and everything here, we have, you know, the space now and everything. Now we have like laser cutting. All that, and it makes it a lot easier, especially batch cutting. But
gotcha. And where do your frames come out of?
Frames, Utah.
Okay.
Yep, the carbon. Yep.
So those are built in Utah, and then does everything get shipped up there, and you guys assemble there?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they get shipped up here. You know, we have our shoulder straps, like everything's kind of batch, like waist belt, shoulder straps, lumbar pads, and stuff like that, and we assemble it here. Like we have a person. There are a couple guys back here that we get in everything, and they're just building frames pretty much all day.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And which it's kind of cool. Like when, you know, we were doing it a lot, especially at shows, like, especially now with that carbon frame, it's super easy to set up. But yeah, so they're just back there piece, you know, we have different boxes of every piece it together and then put it out. That's something like with old Kefaru, you'd order it and you wouldn't get it for like 4 months, you know, cause it's kind of like a special order to where they get it sewn. Like you put in your order, they get it sewn, everything like that. Now we're next day shipping or even same day sometimes, cause the way just streamlining stuff, but yeah, just get it all built, ready to go. And then when you order and piece it together, we have, you know, guys back and shipping and send it off to you. But
gotcha. I wanted to ask you, it's one of the most common questions that I get asked, or like, what are the factors that you should look for in choosing a hunting backpack? And then kind of as a follow-up question, I thought it would be fun for you to rank in terms of importance to you, some different factors. So if you could rank these for me in regard to how important each factor is to you. So, overall weight. So the weight of the frame, the pack, durability, comfort, organization, and then accessibility to your gear and your pack.
Okay, so rank them from like best to
just like what do you consider like what's Kenneth's pick? Are you looking more like, is your top priority being durability? Is it lightweight? Is it comfort?
I'd say number one is going to be comfort, especially comfort under load. And going into that, the initial pack weight and everything like that is going to be at my lowest, because when I'm packing out 100 plus pounds, I don't care about if it was 8 or 6 pounds base weight, you know.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's going to be, you know, I want to have comfort, but also durability is going to be high as well.
Yeah.
The last thing you want, and I've had packs in the past where I'm packing out elk and I'm strap blows out, like, and I'm holding the frame to my back to get it to work for me to even hike out. And what I tell people too is, like, when I'm hunting, and it's just like with your weapon, you want to be confident in your weapon. That's with archery. If you're feeling good in your weapon, you're shooting good, you're going to make that shot a lot easier. Also confident in your gear. So when I was younger and like hunting with subpar packs and stuff like that, or competitors' packs I just didn't trust, I would kind of hesitate if I wanted to kill something somewhere, you know, like, I don't know if I could even get it out, you know? So, after I started using a Kafaru, like before even working for him as a customer, I noticed that was like just a huge game changer, like where I could kill an animal anywhere and I'm going to get it out. I know that the pack's not going to fail, anything like that. My body's going to fail before it does.
Yeah.
It's just that confidence builder and everything like that. But, I'd say top tier is going to be, you know, the comfort, especially under load, durability, and then going down, like the weight, initial pack weight, unless it's like 10 plus, you know, pounds.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a thing.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. But like, I don't worry about that a whole lot. And I've never ever once weighed my packs.
Yeah.
Anytime I go backpacking, or even when I get back from a trip, like,
It's funny how often that's like one of the first questions asked, though. Like, very, very often I would say is like, how much does it weigh? Like, how much does the frame weigh? How much does the whole, you know, the whole kit and caboodle weigh? It's a super common question. I totally get it. I mean, you know, pounds on your back, it adds up, and you're trying to minimize it. And, but I'm with you. I mean, comfort above all, right? And then durability, I would agree. I'm right on board with you. One of the biggest bucks I ever killed, I had it in my backpack, and it wasn't one of the top tier brands by any means, but the shoulder harness ripped out on me. I ended up having to take that thing off and then tie the shoulder harness, you know, the strap back to the actual piece to try to get out. But it was pretty miserable. You know, I've been with my brother that's coming today, actually on that bull that he killed that I mentioned earlier. Packing that bull out, he had the frame completely separate. It was, again, not a top tier brand, but the actual frame itself broke in half, which was miserable. So I would put durability right up there under the tip top. I was curious, I was going to ask you, like, what is it about a Kafaru pack that you think makes it a comfortable pack?
I think lumbar, and like your lumbar system, is kind of the main thing to keep things locked in. That's why, like, our wide hip belts and then like a prominent lumbar pad, it keeps it locked into your hips and in line with your posterior chain. So that's keeping all that weight within your whole body, within your legs, your hips, and up through your back and everything. I think with comfort and like having not such a flimsy frame or anything like that, just kind of having the stability of not being flexed in this way, but it can flex torsionally.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, Kafaru has always been known for being able to haul a lot of weight. You can throw as much weight out on as you can handle and pack it. I think what's biggest is that lumbar support system. Just having that weight that's going to hug your hips and keep it locked into your back with that lumbar pad. You've seen a lot of companies now that are kind of, you know, going more that route, which they should, you know. if you want to have a good system, you want to have something that's going to lock in and not slide. There's other pack companies that have really like smaller waist belts and stuff like that. And you'll kind of get that slide or just not that stability within locking in your hips.
Yep.
But I think that's just something Kafaru has done for a long time when Patrick Smith, you know, created the company and had all those, you know, lumbar waist belt designs.
Yeah.
Was pretty genius, really. And it's just kind of kept us the whole never have changed that, you know.
Gotcha.
But I think the lumbar system and having a rigid frame that's not so much, you know, like different stays that are just going to twist and stuff like that and not slosh around, just very locked in into your back.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think it's super comfortable. You know, I really like the arc frame. I think the hip belt, I like the width of the hip belt. I think it kind of cups your hips, you know, that little crest on your hip. And I've had a really good luck as far as like just enjoying how comfortable I thought the thing was. I was curious how much weight, what's the most weight you think you've ever had in a Kafaru backpack?
So this is, and I've had so many different packouts, and especially solo with elk. There was an elk I packed out three years ago. I packed it out 7 miles back, and I did it in two trips.
Holy cow.
two trips in bone in.
So, no way.
Yeah. Ouch. Yeah. So I was day hunting, which 7 miles back day hunting is not smart, yeah. But when I get on an animal, I get a little autistic, but I,
you're in it. No, yeah, I get it. Totally I've been there. It.
Yeah. And I'm going to get it killed. And I killed that bull around, 2 PM. I believe. Yeah. I shot him around two. Didn't start hiking until like 5, 6, and I didn't get back to the truck till 1 AM with the first load. And the first load, it was the two front shoulders and all the loose meat, packed it out. And then I came back in for the hindquarters, both hindquarters and the head. And that one was pretty heavy.
You did two hindquarters, bone in, and the head.
Yeah.
It had to been 160, 150. I would bet
probably my body weight. Yeah,
at least
it was brutal. Like I remember hiking out, and luckily it wasn't like 7 miles back up like mountain. I killed a bull 5 years ago in Idaho where it was like 5 miles, but it was up a mountain and over. I had to do that in three trips, like for sure. But like it was kind of flatter country, but still it was just a lot of weight, and I had to take a couple stops. That's the first trip was bad. I didn't have any water when I killed him either because it was late season. Mm-hmm. Everything froze. So I ran out of water at 2 PM when I shot him, and then didn't get water till 1 AM when I got back to the truck. And I just remember like getting back and the salt crystals just all over my face. Yeah. And, so that was probably, I'd say the heaviest. Another one, last year, hunting with a buddy, he killed an elk, and it was like 2.5 miles back, but along this like, steep mountain. And he's like, well, we can probably do it in two trips and stuff. I'm like, dude, there's two of us. Like, let's do it in one. Like, I'm like, let's get it. I don't want to pack out, come back and have to pack it out in the dark. And he's like, he's never packed out an elk before in his life. So he's like,
yeah.
And, we ended up deboning it. And he's like, man, I don't know if I could do it. And I'm like, well, I'll pack out. If I can pack out three game bags, then we're going to be good. So there's four total. What I threw on my back was two of the hindquarters deboned and two front shoulders deboned. So it was all the quarters. That was pretty comical. And honestly, that one wasn't even that bad. Like I got it up. Like I'll have to show you a picture of it, but there's meat back. Like it's all
everywhere.
Everywhere. Just falling out. I had the hellbender, just threw it in that low shelf and started going.
Yeah.
But that day before that hunt, I killed a deer in Montana. It was 4 miles back. But I packed in my camp that morning to hunt there for 4 days, and I killed a buck that morning. I had everything, my camp, everything, and I packed that whole deer out in my camp. That one sucked more than packing out that bull with the four quarters. It was just blowdowns going through. I actually fell off blowdowns. Like,
yikes.
Just so much weight. But
no issues with durability, frame, no everything issues. Stayed intact.
Yep, everything stayed intact. I've never had malfunction, even with those weight. Like, that's something it's hard. I don't really talk about it a whole lot because I'm not really like a braggadocious person. Like, when people ask me, like, what's the durability? It's hard for me to be like, well, I could show you all this and like I've done this. But there is proof in the pudding when I have done that. And like, in my own mind, I'm like, this is the most durable thing of all time.
Yeah.
I want everybody to try it.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know. I do like packing weight. Maybe that's a little sick twist in my mind, but I also am in a Kafaru, like in test stuff. So I want to see if there is any fail points because then I can relay that to customers. Not a lot of people are going to be doing that, but even then, if I did have a fail point, I'd have either feedback to come back to Bender about it, or I could tell a customer like, this is how you fix it.
Let me ask you a question. So this is a common, I don't know, maybe it's a myth of some sorts, but, and I've been a proponent of it. I've always said it, like people ask you, or you'll hear people say like, oh, this pack or that pack, you can pack 80-100 pounds in it comfortably. Like it's a comfortable pack with 80 or 100 pounds in it. I've always said, I've never had a pack that was quote unquote comfortable with 100 pounds in it. I've had packs that didn't break. The frame didn't break. The straps didn't break, didn't come apart with 100 pounds in it, but I wouldn't necessarily have called it comfortable.
Yeah.
So what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I would never sit there and tell someone I've been comfortable when I have 100 pounds in my back. Like, you know, like there is a difference. I think
what I've been more comfortable with 100 pounds on my back with some packs than I have with others.
Yes.
So I will say that, but I just feel like I couldn't bluff people and be like, oh yeah, that pack's super comfortable with 100 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. No matter what, it's going to suck in a way. And that's where like your mental toughness comes into consideration. That's a big swing I see just within people. But, what I see more or less is when I get back to the truck and how I feel when I take that pack off,
you know, that's interesting.
You know, like if I say, you know, you get a lot of people be like, oh man, I packed this bull out, whatever. And I was using this pack. And when I got back, I was destroyed for like 2 days, you know, right. Like I couldn't even hunt. And then what I think it's that recovery time of like, how comfortable was it and hard on your body? If there's a lot of weight on your lower back or on your hips or on your shoulders, it's going to put you out a lot longer. Like I said, like last year I packed that buck out and then the next day went hunting, mountain hunting again with, you know, for elk.
Yeah.
Like it's the recovery time and stuff like that. Like I packed a bull out in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 2 days to pack it out. Got back to the truck and I drove 9 hours back home to Oregon. Like right. That same day that I got back, you know, I think it's that recovery time and how you feel after is kind of your big teller on if it was, you know, a quote unquote comfortable pack.
Yeah.
With heavy loads.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a good observation that I haven't really ever put a ton of thought into. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's awesome. That's interesting. Let me ask you. So a common question I get is, you know, how should a hunter, you know, you're going backpack hunting, any tips and tricks on how you should distribute that weight? Like what should that pack look like on you? Like where do you want the hip belt to sit? How do you want your shoulder straps to kind of sit? And I know this is probably where, you know, a visual medium is probably a lot easier to describe this, but maybe you can kind of talk me through it if you can.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's something probably the most common mistake I see. Like when people send me pictures of like, oh, I packed out this bull, packed out this buck. And like, either they say like it was really comfortable or they say like it was really uncomfortable. And I can mm-hmm. tell just how the way the pack was on. The best thing to do is loosen everything up. That's from your waist belt, loosen up your shoulder straps, loosen up your load lifters. So when you put your pack on, especially with a Kafaru, it has that middle seam on the waist belt.
Yep.
You're going to put that right on your hip bone, like right at the top of your hip bone. So it's perfectly in line. And you're going to cinch down your waist belt first, get your lumbar cinched down, and then you're going to do your shoulder straps next. And you can attach your sternum strap if you do, but shoulder straps next and then load lifters last. So what that's going to create is like a perfect rounded of your shoulder straps coming over your shoulder. Yep. Like you want to have it just right touching your shoulder. If there's a pinch, that's because your load lifters were too tight when you tightened your shoulder straps. So you're going to have like a pinch like up there. And that's kind of the most common mistake I see within just putting on your pack is having your shoulder straps too tight or your load lifters too tight when putting down your shoulder straps.
Gotcha.
So then that takes away the whole performance of your shoulder straps.
Yeah.
It's just, there's no contact. So just start from the ground up, and that's with any pack. That's with any of our competitors, just from the ground up, waist belt, shoulder straps, load lifters last.
Gotcha.
Then that'll keep that everything in line. Perfect.
Okay. Another question I get asked a lot is like, how do you actually pack your backpack? So let's say that you're going on a week long, mule deer hunt, archery mule deer hunt. How do you actually load that thing as far as like, how do you put your gear in it? What do you start with first? What pieces of equipment go, you know, towards the back of the frame? Like, how do you actually load it?
Yeah. So mainly it's the whole thing of like, you want that weight kind of upper middle, nothing too high because then that's when you're going to get that sway, nothing too low because that's when you're going to get it like bogging you down.
Yeah.
So mainly like I put my, my tent and my, my sleeping bag in the bottom, vertical. So not horizontal down. So I put those in and then I'll put clothes kind of towards that bottom. That's like puffy jacket or something like that. If something I'm not going to quick access grab, then that's when I'll start building up off of it though. It's when I'll put my stove, food and stuff like that, kind of upper middle, and kind of go to the heavier portion of stuff. And then up at the top is where I'll put like quick access clothing. So it's kind of like lighter weight stuff going up to heavier and then back to light.
Gotcha.
Like, just kind of in between there. And then I usually like my tripod and spotting scope, I'll just strap them onto the sides.
Yeah. What do you do for water?
For water? I'm just just are a Nalgene guy.
Nalgene?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Where do you pack them? Do you put them like in pockets on the outside of the, either on your hip belt or on the outside of the bag themselves? Or do you actually pack your water internally in your bag?
So I every single pack I have and all the frames I have and any waist belt, I have one water bottle pocket on my left waist belt. So it's right there at the ready to grab. So I'll keep that there. And then I carry a 6-liter MSR Drumlight. And that's just when I get to camp and I'll fill up that and then put it next to camp. Or if say if I am like very limited on water, I'll put, you know, whatever, 3 liters into that and I'll just keep it in the pack. And then when if I run out from my Nalgene, I could pour it into there.
Gotcha.
So I'm not never, I used to run a hose quite a bit, but I found myself, I would not drink enough, and which ironically, that's what people say. Yeah. They'll have the hose because they can drink more, but I would not drink enough out of the hose because I think in my mind would get too paranoid on it.
Yeah,
it was too low.
You didn't know how much you had left.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd be like, I need to save it, but I don't even know. And then when I get home, I have like 3 liters still. But so I like having that too. And especially elk hunting, because you're going to be chasing elk where there's water. Mm-hmm. So I can have that Nalgene, be able to fill it up, and you have a Steripen there just to go through it and then keep going. Yeah. But yeah, I haven't used a bladder in probably the last like 5 years, 6 years, but just running Nalgene.
Yeah, first time I pulled up to a trailhead in Colorado with my bag fully loaded, and I pulled it out of the back of my 4Runner and opened the top of it, and you could just see the water running completely through the entire backpack. Yeah, that's been about the last time that I used a water bladder. So while the other guys that I was with, you know, they peeled off and went hunting, I got to lay out all my gear out in the sun and try to dry it out before I could even get going. So
even go, yeah. Yeah. That'll put it down real quick.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about size, which is a common question I get too, but what do you recommend as far as cubic inches for day hunting? You know, maybe a weekend type of hunt. You're going to do 2 nights, 3 days maybe, and then maybe that 5 to 7 days. And then if you guys have expedition, like 10 plus, what do you recommend as far as cubic inches for those types of categories of hunts?
Yeah. So like my favorite day style pack is the Hellbender. It's 2,300 cubic inches, but it has quick access to the load shelf. So you just unclip the compression straps, flay it open, put meat in there, and then start going. So that's my favorite day style pack. And I think I packed out more animals with that than I have anything else. And then for that in-between bag, it's kind of the Bedlam. I like that bag. It's, you know, 4,900 cubic inches when it's fully extended, but when the snow color is over, it's 3,800. So those weekend trips, very easy to pack for it. And then it depends on how people pack. Like I could get 7 days out of that pretty easily, especially with a lid. And then for expedition, it's kind of the Absaroka 6,500 cubic inch bag. And if you add a lid, it's another 750 cubic inches.
Yep.
But so it's kind of, those are the top, like the tier of the packs that I'd run with. If I were to just do one bag though, for everything, I would always get a big bag. Like I would skip that middle and just get the big bag. Just so you can expand for longer trips. You can compress it. And that Absaroka, I don't know if you've like compressed it really tight.
Yeah.
But it does compress pretty well.
Yeah.
So if you're doing day trips, you could use that. But
yeah,
I'd say that's kind of the three packs like going through there. We also have, you know, the Striker XL, which is another day style pack, which is a little bit smaller than the Hellbender's 1900 cubic inches. The new 44 mag that's going to come out will be another in that Bedlam kind of range.
Yep.
Then kind of the Absaroka is still our, you know, expedition pack that's doing really well.
Yeah. Yeah, the advice I've always given to people when they ask me, like, oh, I just want to buy one bag to do them all, you know, to do everything.
Yeah.
Typically what I tell them, I was like, be really honest with yourself. Like, real honesty. How many 10-day trips are you actually going to do? Do you know what I mean?
And like, I'd say zero for most people. Like,
let's be realistic here, you know? And then even like actually how many actual 7-day backpack hunts are you going to do, you know? And if you get real honest with yourself, I mean, I know that people really like the idea of it and the thought of it. But yeah, just be honest with yourself and what, you know, buy a pack that's going to do most of actually what it is that you do, you know?
Yep.
And then, yeah. You know, if you do end up getting a, you know, some sort of expedition, you go, you draw a sheep tag somewhere and you're going to do like a true 10 days, then maybe address it. But if you're going to buy one that is going to cover 99.99% of the hunting you do.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's why I think like the Bedlam too, like yeah. that's a good day style pack, but it's also, you know, can go for those expedition or just, yeah. you know, weekend trips and stuff. But if you're a primary day hunter and like, yeah. you're just going to go route, just get a day pack. Don't get yeah. a big bag. Like you're yeah. not going to need it. You know,
what's your favorite pack in the lineup? Like what are your very favorites?
So it's like, you know, using so many of them and especially when we're testing and stuff like that. The one thing is I love the Bedlam. I haven't worn that for probably the last 2.5 years because yeah. of just, you know, we're going through different packs testing. And like different testing. I'd say my favorite pack right now is probably the Absaroka, just for, cause I do like taking those 5 days backpack trips and stuff like that. But I'd say it's either the Absaroka or the Hellbender.
Gotcha.
I'll use that Hellbender any day style hunt I have. That's going to be the pack that I'm going to be using. With the Absaroka, like I'm going on spring hunt, in a couple weeks really. I'm going to be using that pack for a weekend trip. Like, it compresses really well. I like having the capacity. I like hauling meat inside the bag.
Yeah.
So if I have that extra capacity, I can haul meat inside. But I'd say the Absaroka is probably my favorite right yeah. now.
You know, a pack I really dug, I haven't done a lot of day hunting, but that Striker XL.
Yeah.
You know, going out with my kid and doing some rifle hunting and mostly just like day hunting from a base camp. Mm-hmm. Like I really dig that thing. I really have fallen in love with it. Like I really like yeah. that Striker XL. I think it's a yeah. killer pack.
And that's funny too. Cause I used that pack quite a bit, like 3 years ago, because I was shed hunting quite a bit. I just yep. want, you know, getting out. I haven't done it in quite a while. Kind of got a little bug this year just from other people like wanting to go. And I've been using it the last few weeks. That Striker XL again. I've loved it too. I'm like, this pack yeah. is pretty sweet and been scooping up sheds and stuff. And
have you picked some up?
Yeah. And it's funny cause you were talking about that earlier and, yeah, I've scooped up quite a few already. Yeah.
Oh man. Deer, elk.
Elk. Yeah. So, a few deer sheds. I don't know. I like deer sheds unless I only like them when they're big.
any for the keeper pile?
Nothing so far. I found a brown set 2 days ago for a nice 6-point bull.
Gotcha.
But nothing in the keeper pile so far. Just
yeah,
they're in the cell pile. Where,
the cell
pile. Yeah.
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 I wanted to ask you also, what's your favorite accessories? Because you guys make a ton of accessories, right? Like you do. And I mean, we've mostly talked backpacks, but you guys do all kinds of things, right? You do.
Yeah.
You do some clothing items. You guys do some teepee style tents. But you do an absolute ton of accessories for your packs. Yeah. Like what are your favorites?
I'd say accessories for the packs. Something that's going to be on me at all time is the water bottle pocket.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have that all the time, but like with the Striker XL or the Hellbender and anytime, like with the Striker XL, I use a large, belt pouch on the bottom and then a medium above it.
Mm-hmm.
On the Hellbender, I use a medium belt pouch. Like I think the belt pouches, and if you can add them to the pack, is nice. Being able to organize a little bit and quick access stuff like headlamps and stuff like that. You're not a lid guy.
I'm not. I was going to ask you earlier.
Yeah,
are you a lid guy?
So I am.
And what do you put in it?
So I put, it's a drunk drawer, just like what you're talking about.
That's exactly what it is. This is what I tell Brady all the time. This is a top lid on your backpack is everybody's family household drunk, you know, junk drawer in their kitchen. You just put shit in it that you probably yes. don't need.
Exactly. Like I do. I do put like kind of quick access kind of stuff. Like I'll have you know, my gloves up there or, if there is that top pouch, like on the KU lid, that's where I put my license. But I either drawer like a fire starter and stuff like that. Just yeah. anything I can, I get a drunk drawer, like anything I can just fit in there, I'll throw in there. The only reason I like it, and especially for elk hunting or deer, is I can strap down the heads a lot easier. Like
sure.
just being able to strap them down. They're kind of up, you know, up on your pack.
Yeah.
but you can still do that with the straps that you have.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Is that worthwhile carrying the weight of that thing the entire trip? Because here's the thing, I can find spots for headlamps and gloves and all that stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can find spots for it. So that's always been my thing. Is it's just like, man, it just like kind of sits and flops up on top, and I'm like, I mean, and I get it that people use it and love them, but for me, they're just not for me. Yeah. And I like to give people shit that love them.
Yeah. So when I'm in the summer and I'm scouting, I'd never have a lid. Yeah. Like, never do. But when I'm hunting, like, I'll have a lid on there just to strap stuff down.
Sure.
But that's really the only purpose. But I think like the most versatile accessory we do have is probably the Sherman pocket. Mm-hmm. Because it can expand like on the back of your bag, so you can suck stuff tight with it. If you are a rifle hunter, you can flip it down, put the butt of your stocky rifle in that sleeve, and then strap it back over. But we have so many different ones, and that's kind of the thing, like with Gafaro, because everyone's going to be different. Like you and me, like you're gonna not going to use a lid. I'm going to use a lid.
Yeah.
So you can customize what your style is, and like kind of go if you're going to run just a clean pack, no belt pouches, or you want to have belt pouches and everything. But I see
a lot of people using the Gun Bear. Mm-hmm. Is that the best way to carry a rifle? Is that how you carry it?
I did for a while. Like I liked using it and everything, but after a while, I don't know. I like carrying it. Like I'll just carry it in my hand and
in your hand.
Yeah.
Or do you ever put it on your backpack?
I will occasionally. I typically don't really like putting like a bow on my back.
Me either.
A rifle. I'll just carry it.
I fall,
and that's the thing. I'm not going to fall and then ruin the whole hunt, or, you know, it's like if I fall with it in my hand, I'm going to be able to move it. Or
I'm going to put my hand straight in the air as quick as I can.
Just hold it up.
Yeah, I'm going to go straight to my ribs to save my weapon. Yeah, yes. whatever it takes. I'm the same as you.
And people love to strap it on the back, love the Gun Bear. In the recent years, I've just been carrying it. And then even on pack outs, I'll just have one trekking pole, rifle in my hand or my bow in my hand, and just pack it out. And then once I get back to the rig and I need a second load, I'll just put the weapon away and then go back. Yeah. But yeah, the Gun Bear is sweet. And definitely the Gun Bear is one of our highest selling items.
Yeah.
We sell a ton of them, especially like the Universals, because the Universals can fit any other pack system.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a good, if people want to have, the Gun Bear, it's kind of at the ready. It's in between your armpit and it's just a little clip that clicks it off and you're ready to go. But
What are you wearing for boots? This is probably not a question that you thought I would ask today, but I know that you cover a lot of ground. Mm-hmm. What's important for you in a boot?
So definitely my feet, like, I guess I was blessed, but my feet, I really don't have any issues with them. Like, I have pretty standard, just good arches and everything. The only thing I get is heel rub. So I just tape the back of my heels with Leuco tape and I'm good to go. The boots I've been using in recent, like especially in that early, summer and September, the Zamberlin Baltoro Lights.
Mm-hmm.
I've liked those. And then the Crispy Laponias.
Yep.
I've liked those Laponias. The only thing, the gripe I have with those is I tear apart the outsoles really quick.
Sure.
And doing a lot of miles, and they'll just kind of, most comfortable boot I've probably ever worn is those Laponias. I like having a little more flexibility.
Those are both super flexible boots, I would say.
Yeah. Flexible boots. And I like, and I hauling heavy loads. I haven't seen an issue with that or even some steep country. But the Baltoro Lights and the Laponias, kind of using those quite a bit. I've had a bunch of different Crispy models, like the Colorado, the Wyoming's, Summits. The Summits were actually pretty good too. But my boot system now, it's the Baltoro Light, the Laponia, and then Crispy Nevada, like the leather.
All leather.
Yep, and that's an insulated boot. So, if I'm going in early spring, it's going to be pretty cold, or like when I went to Alaska, I'm having a leather boot, just having that. But I like that boot too.
Have you ever tried anything stiffer?
Yes. So I have, and like,
didn't have good luck with it. Didn't like it. Cause some of that country I know that you hunt is pretty steep. A lot of that, a lot of that elk country. I mean, it's steep stuff, especially when you get up in Alpine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have like the Crispy Thors, like those are pretty, stiff and everything. I've liked them. Like, and that's the thing. Like, I can use any boot and be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But like this last year, when I was hunting those bucks, it was like around 4 miles in, and it was 3,500 feet of elevation gain. So, like, you're getting close, like, very steep country, especially certain parts of it's just straight up.
Yeah.
But I was hiking in with the Laponias and the Baltoro lights and was just fine. It is nice. Yeah. Like, when you have those stiff boots, just put them in the hillside and you kind of just, you know, go up. But I haven't worn a stiff boot probably the last 4 years, probably. Just those Thors. And then I think it was the Hanwag. I forget which one it was.
The
I didn't
Makra.
Wear them for long. Yeah, the Makra. Yeah, I wore those for a little bit. And they're good too, but I don't know.
Yeah. What are you using for socks? If you get heel blisters, do you worry about trying to do like a synthetic liner and then a merino over the top of it? You just basically go straight to Leuco tape and then let her rip, huh?
Yep. just Leuco tape. I usually like, we have our own like Kafaru, like merino socks. Mm-hmm. But then like Darn Tough, I've used Darn Tough for a lot of years. So yeah, I'll just Leuco tape, put a merino sock over it and just start going.
And you go straight to Leuco tape. You don't wait for a hot spot to develop. You just, before you even hit the trailhead, you're already taping up your heels.
Yep. It's religious. Like every time, even if I'm hiking after work, like I did a couple days ago to go look for sheds, in the morning I put Leuco tape on, I put my socks on and I'm just wearing it all day. And then when I go out, I'm ready to go.
As much as you're out and about, you probably just live in that stuff because it doesn't come off.
It doesn't. It takes a while. And like, you know, like the corners will have like.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. You get the dirt outline around on your heel. Yeah, I know exactly. Yeah. You didn't have to say it. I knew where you were going with it.
Yep. I just live in that every day. Take a shower. It still doesn't come off. And then
That's hilarious.
Keep rolling. I guarantee I have it right now. I still will get occasional blisters on the top of my toes, especially if I'm packing something heavy and I'm going downhill.
Going downhill.
Yep. And then at that point, I just tough it out, especially if I'm packing on an animal. I don't really care. Like once I get back to the rig, like it's going to, they'll either pop or they'll heal up and be good. But
yeah, same thing. A heel blister is far worse than like one on the top of your toes, like your small outer toe. Like that one I can kind of live with. But a heel one, man, they can open up and they get deep and they are not fun. Yep.
And they hurt. They'll ruin your whole day.
They hurt.
Like that's, yeah. And that's something I just, over trial and error, I just recognize I'm going to be taping my heels every time. I just, I don't want to deal with it. I buy like 3 rolls of Leuco tape every year. Just, you know, just at the ready in my truck, in my house, just wherever I can. But
when does bear season kick off for you here? Pretty quick, right?
Yeah. So today's the 3rd. So I got a Montana bear tags, which that starts April 15th. So I'm going to hunt that first weekend of April. We have the Mile High Expo this next weekend.
Gotcha.
But I'm going to go hunt that first weekend of season, the second weekend in Montana, and then May 1st, it starts here in Wyoming. So got that. And then I'm actually going back to Alaska May 31st to June 8th to go hunt up there where I was moose hunting last year. We're going to go hunt black bears up there. So
right,
it's going to be a heavy, heavy bear
heavy
spring,
black bear.
Hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. We got 4 tags, I guess, and then whatever, helping other people to get bears. Right. So should be a lot hitting the ground.
Right on, man. Well, good luck. I've had you for an hour and a bit, so I'll cut you loose, but you just said that you're going to be at the Mile High Expo. Is that next week?
Yep. Next week, it'll be April 11th through the 13th.
Okay. So people can stop by and check out packs and visit with you and get fitted.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Come by. We'll talk packs and get you
right going. On. Yep. So anybody listening, you guys can also pop by our gear shop. They're in Vegas. Paul or Norris, they're in the shop, can get you fitted and get you lined out. We carry Kafaru. We chased you guys for a really long time and finally caught up and we're able to work out and be able to carry your packs and your accessories. So you guys can stop in there. Where can people reach out to you and ask you questions? Do you take a lot of DMs and that kind of thing? Or customer service there at Kafaru?
Yeah. So if you know, reaching out to me through Instagram is probably the best way. It's just at Kenneth Thrall. Okay. And then my email, like if your email, my work email is just kthrall@kafaru.net. So that's kind of the only place that I guess I'm ever really reachable.
Yeah.
I don't have a Facebook or nothing like that. But yeah, right. But yeah, just reach out on Instagram, shoot me a DM, and if you have any questions, or shoot me an email, and I'll help you guys out.
Right on. I can give you guys this pack some and accessories like my vote of confidence. I used one all last year and really liked it a lot. Had a pretty good pack out on a bull that I killed by myself and was able to get that one out with no issues whatsoever. I like you guys' accessories. Your little archery hip quiver, field quiver, is one of my favorites. Yeah. Those are awesome. I got mine hanging just in my little bow shop next door here on the hook. And so hopefully I get my brother's bow put together, and we're going to run out and shoot some arrows today. And I love your guys' company. I love what you guys do. So keep it up, and I appreciate you jumping on with me today.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for having me on. And obviously we appreciate you. I appreciate you and everyone there at Go Hunt. Yeah, it's been fun, and hopefully thanks, have another great year.
Yeah. It's, we'll try to stay in touch, and it's always fun to catch up post fall and just see how everybody did and relive some hunting stories. So we'll have to do it again sometime.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Yeah. Thank you.